Their calculator can tell them exactly how much interest they're paying out every day, and I assume they just made a business decision to stop the bleeding.
Exxon decides against appealing the latest settlement decision. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 29th of June. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Readout eruption could be winding down, but a massive explosion is still possible.
It's really just a pile of fresh, hot lava, and it's potentially quite unstable.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Go deep inside Alaska, where the unparalleled meets the unexpected. Fairbanks emanates a quality of light, energy, and warmth found nowhere else on Earth. It's the unexpected Alaska. Fairbanks, located right in your own backyard, is full of activities from the mild to the wild. Experience summer's land of a midnight sun in Fairbanks. Information about attractions, travel, accommodations, and more online at explorefairbanks.com. This message sponsored by the Fairbanks Convention and Visitors Bureau.
The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear Bruce Wyrock's appeal. Wyrock is one of the former Alaska state legislators charged with corruption. He was indicted but never tried. He appealed his mail fraud charge to the Ninth Circuit Appeals Court and lost. But now the U.S. Supreme Court will take another look at it. Wyrock's attorney Doug Pope says federal prosecutors base the charge on a letter the former lawmaker sent to former Vico Incorporated owner Bill Allen asking for a job. They contend it was mail fraud because Wyrock should have disclosed that to his constituents. Pope says there is no state law requiring such a disclosure.
Our position legally is that the mail fraud statute is rooted in the common law of fraud. And the common law of fraud, you could not prove fraud against someone for failure to disclose information unless there was a pre-existing duty to disclose.
The mail fraud charge against Wyrock is one of several charges that revolve around his changing his vote on the state's oil taxation system. The FBI recorded a conversation between Bill Allen and Wyrock about a potential job once he left the legislature. Pope says prosecutors tried to withhold that recording, claiming it was unintelligible. He now has the recording and says it shows his client is innocent.
We want a copy of it anyway. We took it to an enhancing service. We had it enhanced. We could hear the conversation, and there's no deal in the conversation. So the government's case, we think, it will collapse if the Supreme Court rules our way, because they don't have the evidence to support their other claims.
Several of the government's Alaska prosecutions are in trouble because of evidence that was not shared with the defendants in a process known as discovery. U.S. Senator Ted Stevens' conviction was reversed, and jailed former lawmakers Pete Cott and Vic Coring have been released from prison. Plaintiffs in the Exxon Valdez oil spill case got some good news over the weekend. Exxon has decided not to appeal a recent ruling by a three-judge panel from the Ninth Circuit Court, giving victims of the spill interest on their punitive damages dating back to September 1996. KBBI's Casey Kelly has more.
Exxon could have appealed the decision back to the Ninth Circuit Court for review by the full group of judges, or it could have asked the U.S. Supreme Court to consider the case. Lead plaintiff's attorney Dave Esting says he got word last Friday that the company was simply going to pay the interest without further appeal. He says it's one of the last big hurdles in this ongoing legal battle.
It's been going on for so long, it's hard to be overly elated, although I will be as I think about it.
A year ago, the Supreme Court ruled that Exxon owed $507.5 million in punitive damages, one-tenth of the $5 billion an Anchorage jury awarded plaintiffs in 1994. That came as a blow to those who waited almost 20 years while the case wound its way through the legal system. Exxon then claimed that it should only have to pay interest on the ruling from the time of the high court decision. The Ninth Circuit panel disagreed, saying the company owed interest dating back to September 26, 1996, the date when the district court in Anchorage entered judgment in the case. Esting says the interest basically doubles the settlement for plaintiffs.
I mean, I'm sure they had to evaluate their probabilities of success and decide whether, in fact, you know, and whatever Exxon-centric decisions they want to make about their business affairs, and came to a conclusion that with those two ideas combined, that it was time to pay the balance due.
My speculation is that it's purely dollars and cents.
That's Frank Mullen, a fisherman, Exxon plaintiff, and financial planner in Homer.
Their calculator, it can tell them exactly how much interest they're paying out every day. And from that perspective, I assume they just made a business decision to stop the bleeding.
Mullen says attorneys informed plaintiffs of Exxon's decision over the weekend at the annual meeting of the United Cook Inlet Drift Association. Like Esting, he says it's hard to be excited at this point, although the decision is certainly good news.
We were extremely disappointed in what the Supreme Court did to us a year ago. You know, the reduction in the award was something that was pretty hard to take after waiting 20 years. On the flip side of that, I'm personally going to be thrilled to see that it's that the end is in sight.
Despite its decision not to appeal the interest issue, Exxon is still fighting the issue of legal fees. Lead attorney Esting says that could mean a $70 million difference in the amount paid to plaintiffs.
Exxon believes because of the substantial reduction in the judgment, they were the prevailing party, which is a term of art, in the litigation, and that therefore plaintiffs should bear some or all of Exxon's appeal bond costs for the interminable appeals that they've pursued.
Esting's not sure when a decision will come on that issue, but says plaintiffs' attorneys are confident that they'll win there as well. He says interest payments will be handled through the Exxon Qualified Settlement Fund, which began cutting punitive damages checks late last year. He hopes to see the first interest checks mailed out by mid-August. In Homer, I'm Casey Kelly.
Legislators are beginning to take a look at rewriting parts of the state tax on natural gas during next year's session, in particular removing some elements of the current tax structure that could end up reducing the state's revenue if gas were actually put in a pipeline from the North Slope to the lower 48. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
At the time the current oil and gas taxes were written, legislators set the gas portion aside so they could focus on oil. But with the new possibility of a gas line, a problem's come to the surface. It's a floating tax rate called progressivity that collects more revenue as profits rise, and it falls as profits go back down. When it was last before the legislature, progressivity was described as a way to share high profits while providing a floor to guarantee a base tax when those profits fell. It still applies to a combination of oil and gas production. House Finance Co-Chair Mike Hawker explains that the ideal revenue return is based on a barrel of oil costing six times more than 1,000 cubic feet of gas, because that's where they produce an equal amount of energy.
And the tax is based on allocating your costs on that energy equivalency. Now, the fact is that oil is selling at a great premium over gas. When you have this disconnect between price equivalency and energy equivalency, the state loses money on the taxes.
The existence of the progressivity problem was first pointed out in a report by analyst Dan Dickinson during the regular session this year. He showed that as oil and gas prices deviated from the 6-to-1 ratio, the tax base was diluted. Using an example where oil prices were 13 times higher than gas prices, he showed the state would lose $70 million a year. That's the same as no tax on gas and still a reduction in the oil production tax and lower state revenue. Detractors predicted that a wide price spread would not happen often and it would normalize around the expected 6-to-1 ratio. However, lawmakers are now looking at how wide the spread has gotten since February, when gas prices dropped and oil began its upswing. Now the gas-to-oil price spread is 18-to-1. Senate Finance Co-Chair Bert Stedman said if today's spread were an annual average, the total cash loss to the state would be closer to $800 million.
We have a huge, huge potential impact to the Treasury. And when you look at the global energy demand, with the world awash in natural gas and oil becoming more valuable, it appears that that normal 6-to-1 energy equivalency between gas and oil historically is going to be a thing of the past.
As a simple fix, members are talking about a separation of oil and gas taxes. They call it decoupling. That way, each resource would be calculated separately so neither resource could dilute the value of the other. Dickinson suggests they should be cautious if they do that, however. He says, Since Alaska's progressivity is not widely used in the world and has only been in place for 3 years, there's no base of knowledge to judge its long-term effect.
It's clear that people don't know precisely what the best solution is, and a simple decoupling is going to, unfortunately, may have consequences for the whole reason that we went from a gross tax to a net tax back in 2006.
Dickinson says lawmakers must understand that separate accounting for oil and gas is not simple. Accounting systems make it difficult to keep apart the cost of oil and gas production from return on investment in each resource. Stedman agrees. He says gas has to be looked at as a standalone tax source, but he says that doesn't mean the entire tax structure needs to be rewritten. Dickinson's under contract to provide some fiscal models for legislators. They'll be able to see for themselves the immediate effects of decoupling. That'll be available in November. The Revenue Department did not respond to several requests to give the Palin administration's position on the legislative concerns. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, unlocking the secrets of a massive underwater canyon in the Bering Sea.
The largest seabird colonies in the world are on St. George Island, fed directly through the waters from Pribilof Canyon.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Operating a forklift is serious business, and operators are required to be properly trained and certified. The emotional and financial damage can be severe when a family member never comes home from work or comes home with a debilitating injury due to a forklift accident. Training information is available at 1-800-656-4972. Good, safe jobs are Alaska's future. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Congressman Don Young announced his plans today to run for re-election. The 19-term Republican filed his paperwork at the Division of Elections in Anchorage this morning for the 2010 race. It's far ahead of when Young typically declares his candidacy. Last Congress, he waited until late May 2008, just 5 months before Election Day to file. This time he's giving more than 16 months' notice. Young says he wants to cut down on speculation.
My wife and I to go ahead and put to rest any idea that we were not running. There was some rumors sort of flowing around the state that the possibility because of our great victory in November that we would go out with that and not continue to serve the people of Alaska.
Last year, Young won re-election by 16,000 votes, defeating Democrat Ethan Berkowitz in what was expected to be a nail-biter of a race. Congressman Young has been investigated as part of the federal government's probe of oilfield services company VECO and its corruption ties. Young has not been charged with any wrongdoing. He calls any possible cloud around him manufactured by the media. But in December, he stepped down from his powerful ranking spot on the House Natural Resources Committee after pressure from Republican colleagues because of ongoing investigations. Young says that doesn't matter because he says he has good relationships with Democrats now in power, especially ones that run committees.
It doesn't make much difference as long as I've got the friendship and the relationship with the D side, and I do. John Dingell I would say Jim Oberstar, those chairmen of the major committees that affect Alaska, we have a very close working relationship. So I'm able to respond to the needs for Alaskans because of that, and only long-term service can give you that.
Alaska's only congressman has served in the U.S. House for 35 years. Scientists keeping a close eye on Mount Redoubt are starting to see signs the volcano may be settling down. But the aviation alert level is still at code orange, and staff at the Alaska Volcano Observatory plan to continue monitoring Redoubt 24 hours a day. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Mount Redoubt's last major explosive event happened on the morning of April 4th. The volcano sent a plume high into the air and ash falling on the Kenai Peninsula. Since then, Redoubt has been slowly oozing out magma from the Earth's crust and puffing a steady column of steam. Allison Payne is a geologist with the Alaska Volcano Observatory.
The public thinks the volcano has maybe been boring the last couple of months, but on the contrary, it's been erupting and building up this pile of lava that is then basically building the edifice of the volcano. So the last couple of months at Redoubt, we have been building a mountain.
Mount Redoubt's dome is the largest scientists have seen since the volcano began erupting in March. It has grown so large, it's now the size of 17 Louisiana superdomes and more than 600 feet tall.
So it's massive. It's hard to imagine, actually, but when you fly up around the volcano and see it, it's very humbling.
In the last few weeks, though, the rate that dome is growing has slowed. Payne says lava may still be erupting on the surface in an amount that's too small to detect. But the volcano doesn't have to be burping magma to spur another explosion. The towering dome could create its own dramatic episode.
It's really just a pile of fresh, hot lava, and it's potentially quite unstable. And so even without a change in the magmatic system, that lava dome could just fail due to gravity. And that would cause another large explosion like we've seen with ash fall, possible flooding in the Drift River Valley, possible pyroclastic flows, and all of those associated hazards.
The dome could also slowly cool over months or years, solidifying into place. That's what finally ended the last eruption cycle of Mount Redoubt 2 decades ago. But Payne says if the dome does collapse, it will create an impressive explosion.
I believe it would be possibly the largest explosion we've had during this eruptive phase, simply because of the massive amount of fresh, unstable lava that's up there at the summit. I would expect a very high cloud of ash and significant flooding.
All the scientists at AVO have their own theories about what will happen next, but Payne says the growing consensus is that Mount Redoubt is quieting down. The one sure bet is that the volcano will keep Alaskans guessing. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The abundance of the Pribilof Island ecosystem is linked to a nearby but poorly understood canyon. A team of researchers is mapping the canyon and some of the surrounding ecosystems to understand what happens in the biologically diverse Bering Sea Islands. KUCB's Ann Hillman spoke with the head scientist.
A team of technicians and scientists recently mapped the shape and floor of the Pribilof Canyon near the Pribilof Islands. Marine ecologist Michelle Ridgway is with Oceanus Alaska and the Alaska Deep Ocean Science Institute. She worked with a group of technicians from TerraSond aboard the research vessel Mount Mitchell to use multi-beam sonar technology to create fine detailed maps showing the canyon floor and the types of sediments in the area. She says the canyon is biologically significant for the entire Pribilof Island ecosystem.
It's the physical and oceanographic connection with Pribilof Canyon that many believe is largely responsible for the diversity and abundance of species around the Pribilof Islands, such as fur seals, seabirds. The largest seabird colonies in the world are on St. George Island. Fed, it appears, directly through nourishment and enrichment of the waters from Pribilof Canyon.
Ridgway explains that the shape of the canyon causes water currents to form large whirlpools that whip up nutrients, concentrate them, and then push them into the marine system.
The shape of the canyon walls is such that the ocean currents hitting the sides of these walls become compressed and shoot this water up onto the shelf right at the Pribilof Islands. So this dynamic process of concentrating food and then advecting it up onto the shelf is responsible for nourishing the nearshore waters around the Pribilof Islands.
Mapping the canyon will help scientists better understand the relationship between the biological systems and the geomorphology. It will also help them know what's on the canyon floor. The mapping system can sense different sediment types. This information can be matched up with images gathered from a 2007 Greenpeace expedition that used small submersibles to take photos and video of the canyon. Some of the video shows forests of seawips. Other areas are barren.
From a scientific perspective, this data will be invaluable for people involved with modeling the seawater currents in Pribilof Canyon and for doing geospatial analysis of biological functions within the canyon, like where all the plankton is blooming and identifying with more precision where rockfish habitats are and what the features of those habitats are for certain species.
Ridgway says the canyon is of particular interest because it's been prime fishing grounds since the days of the Russians. Fishing groups helped the National Ocean Survey fund the study. The information will also be used to update nautical charts. While near the Pribilofs, Ridgway and her crew also used the multi-beam sonar technology and the backscatter data to complete a pilot study looking at blue king crab habitat. They wanted to see if the technology could distinguish between different surface materials, mud, gravel, sand, and shell hash.
Shell hash is simply crushed up seashells. And this habitat type lies around the Pribilof Islands in nearshore waters.
And it seems to be crucial for the survival of Pribilof Island blue king crabs.
There's lots of spaces between shells, and the shell hash is very soft compared to gravels. There are hiding spaces for the little crab to hide from predators at their very young and vulnerable stages.
Ridgway says that mapping the area will help scientists learn more about king crab habitats and what habitat factors might help their populations recover. The blue king crab populations crashed in the 1990s, and the fishery has been closed since 1998. The red king crab fishery was closed, too, to prevent incidental catch. The past 10 years, the population has not recovered. Ridgway says they aren't exactly sure why. It could be disease, predation, habitat change, or the effect of removing most of the large male crabs from the population.
We need to have large male crab to mate with large females. Also, by culling out the large males, it's possible we can remove that set of genes for large crab from the gene pool, and those can certainly have population-level effects over time.
Their pilot test showed that the sonar technology could distinguish between the types of habitat. Ridgway hopes to return later in the summer to take samples of the floor and physically confirm the sonar information before doing a full-scale project. Data from the canyon mapping is still being analyzed. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the new AT&T, your world delivered,
and by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
Crews had resumed work preparing to recover fuel from the sunken ship Monarch in Cook Inlet, but they now have a new strategy after initial difficulties and more delays as a diver had medical concerns. KDLL's Ben Stanton has more.
The Monarch sank in January near the Granite Point platform about 16 miles from Nikiski with an estimated 30,000 gallons of diesel on board. Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation Program Specialist Steve Russell says workers from Global Diving removed about 950 gallons of fuel 2 weeks ago. Then the mooring for the staging ship Perseverance started slipping because of powerful tides. So they brought in a smaller ship, the Sand Island, to stage the dives.
A smaller dive vessel that's used by Global Diving fairly regularly. And they continue diving operations to do preparation work for fuel recovery. They stopped fuel recovery efforts and focused primarily on preparation, removing hatches, clearing debris, and things like that.
After work resumed, it stopped again Wednesday when there was a safety concern. One of the divers appears to have experienced nitrogen narcosis, known as the bends. That's when nitrogen that's dissolved in the blood forms bubbles during certain changes in pressure. Russell says the diver is okay.
As a safety precaution, they ceased dive operations, installed the diver in the hyperbaric chamber, and had him medically evaluated after that. And that triggered, any incident like that triggers a complete safety evaluation.
That more comprehensive self-exam includes review of policies and procedures and inspection of equipment. Russell says safety is very important in the dives, especially in this part of Cook Inlet. They avoid diving during times when the tides move at 4 or 5 knots or more, but there are still strong currents when they do dive. In addition, water depth can change significantly and visibility can be near zero.
Everything is done by feel. in approximate at low tide, it's 70 feet of water. At high tide, it's approximately 90 feet of water. So it's a complex operation that takes some pretty careful thought and planning, and you certainly don't want to have any risks involved in that.
Russell says they might decide to bring the 220-foot Perseverance back during the fuel recovery if they redesign the mooring system, but he says a 70 to 80-foot sand island will be enough to stage work like removing hatches, cutting bulwarks, and removing debris to gain access to fuel tanks. Recovery could start in about a week and could take a week to 10 days. After fuel removal, the Monarch will be salvaged if possible. In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs, Alaska Region, will soon be under new leadership. KDLG's Adam Kane has the story.
BIA in Alaska has been in the spotlight recently due to a report released in February of this year that recommended withholding funding for specific programs. The report submitted to the U.S. Secretary of the Interior, Ken Salazar, stated that the BIA Alaska Regional Indian Reservation Roads Program was, quote, rife with mismanagement and lacking program oversight. Also in the report, Inspector General of the Interior Department, Earl Devaney, noted that due to inattention to expenditures and failure to manage its programs, millions of tax dollars were wasted or unaccounted for. The report was related to issues that occurred as a chain of events within the BIA. Regional Director for the BIA in Alaska, Niall Caesar, explains what became of the report.
The IG's report listed numbers of problems, and you know, I agree that some of those issues were in fact right on, but it was resource driven. It wasn't management mistake driven, and the resources were not controlled by the region. They were controlled by Washington, D.C. That just, you know, was a death knell for us.
Caesar was notified on June 11th of the directed reassignment. He will now become the BIA's Midwest Regional Director based out of Minneapolis. The previous Midwest Regional Director had recently retired. With the loss of Caesar as director, a position he's filled for 19 years, there will be an opening at the BIA. In Dillingham, I'm Adam Kane.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Homer, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Ben Stanton in Kenai, and Adam Kane in Dillingham. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Our intern is Susanna Caldwell, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org. Want to break your tobacco addiction? Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-QUIT. Register for free Quit Line counseling and nicotine replacement patches. The combined counseling and patches increase your chances of quitting for good. Trained quit coaches will help you set a quit date and send you information. Free quit services are available to all Alaskans. This message is from the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. 1-888-842-7848.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.